Yeah, so now we can actually, having had a look at very briefly at the first two sections of the Dual Liberation, we can come on to the third chapter. So it happens very early on in the book, meeting spiritual friends. So let me read you a little bit from Gampopa. So he begins, the heading of meeting spiritual friends is this: the contributory cause are spiritual friends. This means that although you may possess the most perfect working basis, but are not urged on by spiritual friends as a contributory cause, it is difficult to set out on the path towards enlightenment because of the power of inveterate propensities due to evil deeds committed repeatedly in former lives. Therefore, you have to meet spiritual friends. So this is how strong language, stern language, in a way. But this is the first point he makes. So we might have all the individual equipment necessary. We've got the potential for enlightenment. We've got a really good working basis. We've even developed our faith to some extent. We're searching. But he's saying unless we can meet spiritual friends, that's not enough. He's basically saying we can't do it on our own. We need the supportive conditions of spiritual friendship in order to follow the path. This, by the way, is what makes the Buddha's enlightenment so remarkable, because of course he didn't have a teacher. I mean, there were people who did instruct him in realizations which were essentially part of samsara, Alara Kalama and Mudraka Ramaputra, but he had nobody to show him the way to enlightenment. So this is the uniqueness of the Buddha's enlightenment, you know, that he was somebody who rediscovered enlightenment on his own without a teacher, and then taught it widely. And there's a strange sort of paradox with this, because although Gampopa is saying we need spiritual friends in order to practice the Dharma, he wants the end of the enlightenment that he's talking about is the enlightenment of a fully enlightened Buddha. So he wants us, you know, and of course this is going to happen a long time in the future, not just to get a little bit of enlightenment that makes ourselves feel a bit better in this life, not just a bit of personal liberation. He wants us to fashion ourselves into a man who can rediscover the path to enlightenment when it's been lost. That's what he wants us to do. That we're going to take up a spiritual practice that will turn us into that kind of hero. I mean, it's really quite a bold, that's an understatement, extremely bold vision. But in this life, we've come to the Dharma, we need spiritual friends. And he says we need them to urge us on. It's quite interesting that in this little opening summary, he talks about being urged on. And that's, of course, one of the main things you get from friends in the Dharma, spiritual friends, is that you get encouragement. They encourage you to keep going, to not turn back, to not give up. They'll encourage you in all sorts of ways. Maybe it will be inspirational encouragement. Maybe it will be rejoicing in your qualities. Maybe at times it will be challenge. It will be really kind of getting you to look at yourself and the way you're kind of avoiding the Dharma. But in one way or another, we need friends to urge us on in Dharma practice, to remind us of what life is really about, and to also instruct. He's very, very concerned with that. This is quite important, that it's not just sort of Buddhist pals he's talking about. He's saying real spiritual friends give us not just the urging, but the instruction that we need in order to practice the Dharma effectively and successfully. And why? Why is it so difficult without spiritual friends? Why is it difficult to set out on the path towards enlightenment? Because of the power of inveterate propensities. I forgot to look up inveterate propensities. Anybody know what inveterate propensities means? I think I've got the feeling for it. Any dictionary people here? Kusala?
Propensity means a tendency.
A tendency. Inveterate?
Kind of stubborn.
Stubborn.
Unchanging.
A stubborn and unchanging propensity. Tendency. Thank you for that, Krista. And these are powerful. It says due to evil deeds committed in repeatedly in former lives. Gampopa's perspective, there's no argument with him about rebirth. You know, the reason why we're trapped in samsara is because of our previous actions. And of course, rebirth for us Westerners is often a bit problematic. We just don't, you know, think in those terms very easily or readily. Don't need to have an argument about that. But I think you'll all agree, whether you think in terms of rebirth or not, we can all probably agree that we all have inveterate propensities. Stubborn, fixed tendencies which have nothing to do with the path to enlightenment. Deep forces that make it difficult for us to practice. Deep habitual material. If you've been around our Buddhist community for a while, you know there are certain sort of words that enter the language. A recent one is sanskaras. Have you heard that one? I've got this sanskara that makes it very difficult for me to practice. I've got this sanskara. Sanskara is really an inveterate propensity. Sanskara means like deep habit patternings, deep conditionings. I have to admit, I think sometimes this word sanskara is being used as a way of really avoiding engaging with the inveterate propensity. I'm hearing people say sanskaras as if that's the end of the story. If you've got sanskaras, if you've got some inveterate propensities going on, you better jolly well do something about it right now, because, you know, if they're that inveterate, they're going to be very, very difficult to change. So just because there are these deep habits, it doesn't mean that you shouldn't make inroads on them and really work on them. And you can, because you can set up other habits. The teaching of sanskaras, of these sort of deep, as it were, karmic forces, also works the other way. Not only do we have inveterate propensities, which are to do with samsara, we also have propensities for nirvana. We do, if we didn't have positive creative patterns that we've established, if you don't like the word habit, well, we wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be living this life. So it's really important to develop the positive, to develop positive habits, to push back the inveterate propensities. It is really important. Have you ever wondered why there's so much repetition in Buddhism? Same meditations at the same time, the same chanting, going over the same text, the same teachings again and again and again. So it goes right against the sort of era in which we live, which thrives on novelty, novelty value, entertainment. You know, basically we just love being entertained, and you know, people can find Buddhism boring because it just, you have to repeat the same lessons, the same practices again and again and yet again. And the reason for this is to set up positive patterns to push against the inveterate propensities. Here I think it's quite important and useful to bring in the Yogacara, if you like, vision of our consciousness. Yogacara has this very, very profound analysis of, if you like, the layers of our consciousness. They say that human consciousness has eight consciousnesses. There's the six sense consciousnesses, because mind is regarded as a sense. And then, as it were, beneath that or vitiating that is what they call the defiled mind consciousness, the consciousness that sets up grasper and grasped, that sets up a distinction, a hard and fast distinction between self and other, sets up a fixed self, a fixed other. That's the basic sort of delusion that entraps us. But as it were, beneath that, there is what they call the alaya vijnana, the storehouse consciousness. Alaya means store, where all of our willed actions, skillful or unskillful, all the effects of those actions are going into that deep consciousness. It's not something that you can even be aware of. It's just all the time we're seeding that consciousness with either skillful bijas, skillful seeds, or unskillful seeds. They also use the language of perfuming. We're constantly influencing and perfuming that deep level of consciousness, whether the skillfulness or unskillfulness. It's just going on all the time. And they don't just call the Alaya a store, they also call it a torrent, a stream, it's like a river. You know, and I've often said we're often very concerned about the pollution of our rivers and so on, but what about the pollution of our consciousness? What about a little bit of internal ecology? What about a bit of environmentalism of the mind? An ecology of consciousness. Perhaps the reason why we make such a mess of things out there is because we're making a mess of things inside. So, and the thing is, none of this just all stays. And under certain conditions, the effects of previous actions will rise up. Within us through the external stimulus that comes, and that will either lead to failure or success spiritually. But the great positive side of this, let's not dwell on the negative, is that we can seed that deep consciousness with positive forces, positive habit energies, as it's sometimes called, positive seeds. And they, under certain conditions, can sort of rise up for our benefit. So this business of repetition, of really repeating things, not blindly, not like a parrot, but with real heart, with, you know, really bringing our heart, and to use a non-Buddhist language, our soul into it, into all our practices, that's having an effect, a transformative effect. Buddhism isn't really about having big experiences. It's not really about that, although it's sometimes taught like that. It's about setting up the continuous rhythm of Dharma life, day in and day out, building up this tendency, moving against the inveterate propensities, building up this very, very positive tendency through our Dharma life. And then you get the opening up of real attainment. Sangha actually is often very fond of quoting one of his the Hindu teachers that he met in his early wandering days, of the rock that breaks on the 20th blow. So 20 times you hit this great big rock and nothing seems to be happening, but on the 20th it actually shatters. Well, those 19 blows on the rock are bringing about invisible seismic changes, and yes, the 20th is the coup de grace. But without those 19 blows before, there wouldn't be anything. So we need to push back the inveterate propensities which make it difficult to practice through habitual, the habit of practice, repetition. And it's spiritual friends, of course, that help us do that, that urge us to keep practicing, that urge us to keep going. I've seen this so many times. You know, at Padmaloka, I've been here for more than 20 years now, and somebody will come on retreat. Sometimes it might even be an order member, hasn't been here for a long, long time, a few years even, something like that. And you know, we're all very pleased to see them. And you know, they, within a day or two, they say, "Oh, I've just remembered why I'm a Buddhist. I've just remembered why I'm a Buddhist." And I can't believe that I've forgotten all this. Why are they remembering? Because they're meeting spiritual friends. Nothing new being communicated. It's the same Dharma. It's not that there's some fancy new teaching that's making it better. But they've come into an environment of spiritual friendship, which brings the teachings and the trainings alive. And they remember what they're about. And they get back into those positive habits. So this is why we need spiritual friends. Sometimes it's not even, it's even enough just to be around them. You don't need anything other than to be around them. Sometimes people have said to me that as they near Padmaloka, quite a few people have said this, as they get nearer to Padmaloka, they feel their consciousness changing because their associations with coming to Padmaloka are so positive in terms of the Dharma. They really feel something beginning to awaken that's been a bit asleep you know, in the intervening period. So we need our spiritual friends. And of course, they're not just at Papaloka, they're in the local centre, they're in our communities, and so on and so forth. But we need that living connection with people who are practicing the Dharma like us. Maybe even they're practicing a bit more intensively than us, to push back those inveterate propensities. I think another thing that we don't realise is how conditioned our Dharma life is. It's very, very conditioned. We really do need to wake up to Praticca Samuppada, conditioned co-production. Buddhist life doesn't just sort of happen spontaneously. Like anything else, it's dependent upon conditions. Internal conditions, in terms of the efforts that we make to practice, we have to keep all that alive and happening through conscious effort. You can only relax when you've entered the street, when you're irreversible from enlightenment, and then you don't relax because effort is natural then, it's spontaneous. You keep going naturally, but you need the internal conditions of effort, but you also need the external conditions, really supportive conditions, and primary among those is spiritual friends, spiritual friends of all kinds, who urge, encourage, who remind us of how to practice. Another way you can describe these inveterate propensities which take us off the path is deep emotions. Do you remember that very old lecture by Sangharakshita in the Eightfold Path series? Perfect emotion, still incredibly relevant lecture, will never go out of date, where he says, the central issue for most people, and I think by most he means everybody, most people in the spiritual life is to find emotional equivalence for intellectual understanding. That's a tremendous insight. Very simple. Emotional equivalence for intellectual understanding. We know all about Buddhism. We know enough to gain enlightenment 100 times over. We know that we should love everybody and not hate everybody and be indifferent to people. We know all that. We know that it's best to observe the precepts and so on and so forth. We know that meditating is a good idea every day. But do we keep doing it? He tells the story how, you go to bed at night with all sorts of resolutions to get up early to meditate. And then the next day, you get up, and overnight, there's been a revolution. There's been a coup. And, the Buddhist has been completely overthrown by other forces. They don't want to meditate. Well, it's not just an integration issue, it's an emotional issue. To do with how connected are your emotions with the Dharma. And of course, this is where friends are so important. People touch us. People affect us much, much more than ideas. Very often our emotional life is bound up, with our connections with our parents and early life experience and all that sort of thing. We need to be with people who are real spiritual friends. And part of spiritual friendship is people who are consistently positive, consistently friendly, consistently helpful and supportive. That is going to spark off our deeper emotions. Spiritual friends also mean that we have the arena, the environment, in which we can express our own higher emotions and insights and understandings. So often people tell me that, what a relief it is to come here or go to their centre or going for refuge group or whatever it might be, because so much of their life is spent with non-Buddhists. And it's not that those people are bad people, they're not saying that, but the possibility of full expression of their real feelings for the Dharma and what they're really working on is just not there. And if that expression isn't allowed, it will atrophy. It will dry up, it will die or wither. We need to be able to express our deeper feelings, emotions, insights, imaginings, longings, confident that they'll be really heard, not just with the ear, but with the heart. And people will take us seriously. Perhaps even reflect a little how lonely you might have felt sometimes when you were beginning to discover you had these feelings for something like the Dharma, the intuitions that were arising. And there was nobody to talk to about them. Extremely painful. Extremely painful. Probably one of the most painful things. Or if you did express them, people were cynical or dismissive or indifferent. So one of the reasons why we need spiritual friends is for our own expression. You know, to be able to fully express metta without there being any room for misunderstanding. To express that kind of love widely with people who are really going to get it. That's really tremendously important. So yes, we need spiritual friends, you know, in our life if we're going to get on the path to enlightenment. So he then wants to give the reasons why we need spiritual friends. And the first reason he gives, which might seem a bit odd to you, is scriptural authority. Scriptural authority. In other words, spiritual friends are important because the Buddha says so in the sutras. Now, we should just say this only works if you actually have faith in the Buddha. If you have confidence and faith in the Buddhist tradition. It doesn't work if you don't. Something is only an authority like that for you if you have that kind of living confidence. It's not you're a bad person if you don't obey the Buddha and find spiritual friends. That's more like the scriptural authority from theistic traditions, which is rather different. But if you do find that, you know, through your experience, that the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition really speak to you, really mean something to you, they will become a personal authority for you. Not you go around and tell other people that they're the authority for them, but for you, they have weight. They have real weight. So when the Buddha says, and he quotes this, virtuous disciples having respect for the teacher, means spiritual friend, should always be in touch with wise teachers, because from them the virtues of a wise man spring. Thus a bodhisattva, another sutra, thus a bodhisattva mahasattva who wishes to attain unsurpassed enlightenment must first approach, then meet and honour spiritual friends. In the text, it must be true. Well, but then he goes a bit further. He talks about necessity, and here, in a way, he's sort of repeating himself. The necessity, the direct, practical necessity of meeting spiritual friends. They're necessary because you yourself do not know how to accumulate qualities and how to tear the two veils of conflicting emotions and primitive beliefs about reality. This is indisputable. You know, you have to remember Gampopa is he's a completely convinced Buddhist master that you need spiritual friends because you don't know how to develop qualities yourself, the qualities necessary to follow the path, and because you don't know how to tear the veils between you and reality. Of what this translator calls conflicting emotions and primitive beliefs about reality. A bit of an explanation about this. So conflicting emotions is the translation of the word klesha. Klesha can be translated as passions, but it's best translated as defilements or defiling afflictions. So it's a veil between us and reality. So there's lots of lists of kleshas, but the kleshas are things like craving, hatred, jealousy, pride, ignorance, confusion. The list goes, there's very, very long lists of these defilements. So they're like a veil. We don't see things as they are because of these negative emotions. And that veil needs to be taken down. But there's also a veil of primitive beliefs about reality. Quite eccentric translation. The word is gnaya, the veil of knowables. And to cut a long story short, it's basically any kind of belief, any kind of wrong view about there being anything fixed and permanent. That's a veil. And of course, these two things reinforce each other. The emotive, affective side of things, the klesha, the craving and the hatred and so on, reinforce the fixed view of things, the view that fixes ourself and world. And that view, that attitude, that opinion reinforces the negative emotions that we hold. Spiritual friends show you how to work on that. They show you how to deal with that through the practices that they teach and through noticing when you are indulging negative emotions, when you're involving klesha, and when you're rationalising that behaviour through some sort of view that fixes yourself and others. That's what spiritual friends do. More positively, they reveal, you know, the nature of the way things are, the nature of reality, and how to follow the path to enlightenment. And Gampopa says this is indisputable. This is what spiritual friends do. And it's worth, I think, sort of reflecting. Well, I'll just read another phrase, actually, another paragraph. And so for people like ourselves, who intend to attain perfect Buddhahood, it is necessary to accumulate all those qualities necessary for enlightenment. But the means of accumulating them depends on spiritual friends, and it is equally necessary to tear the two veils of conflicting emotions and primitive beliefs about reality. But the means of doing so, again, depends on these friends, people like ourselves. So let's reflect on this a bit. And I think when we talk about spiritual friends, we usually think of friends in terms of the people that we see each day who encourage and inspire and support us, you know, and going along to the centre and hearing the Dharma. And of course, those living spiritual friends are absolutely vital. But Gampopa has an even larger conception of spiritual friends. Those near spiritual friends work or happen because they're part of that lineage I talked about earlier. We can say that the Buddha is our, if you like, our ultimate spiritual friend, because we're practicing the Dharma that removes those defilements, that veil of defilements, and the Dharma that reveals the way things are. We're doing that because of his teaching. All of the meditation practices that we do are about that. Metta Bhavana is the way, the great way of removing the veil of the kleshas, the veil of defilements, mindfulness of breathing as well. Dharma study and contemplation of the Buddha's teaching in deep meditation, and there are many ways of doing this, is a way of removing the veil of misknowing. But it all comes from the Buddha, transmitted through, you know, all of the great teachers of the past, down to our own teachers, down through, in our case, Sangharakshita, of course, the teachings that he's transmitted, and even our spiritual friends, you know, at our local centre and so on, the spiritual friends that we have, you know, within the order. All these are acts of spiritual friendship. Without that, without the Buddha arising, and without the teachings being transmitted through spiritual friendship, we would not be able to remove these veils. It's very important, I think, to remember that when we talk about spiritual friendship, when we talk about spiritual friends, it's not just sort of a Buddhist sociability. You know, we're sort of Buddhist mates. It's not that ordinary friendship isn't important. That's so important, that sort of ease that you can have with one another, and that relaxed, even playful kind of quality that you can have in ordinary friendship. I think it's tremendously important to have all that. But it's much, much deeper than that. It's about a much more serious purpose of taking up and really using the practices that lead to liberation. So when we talk about meeting spiritual friends, we're talking about meeting, if you like, with the living Buddhist tradition. That's what Gampopa means, and that's what it means for us. The living Buddhist transmission that's come down to us into this time, into this moment. The living Buddhist tradition that we can actually use here and now in order to gain liberation. You know, sometimes, you know, people they say to me, well, I really like you, Padmavajra, and I find you really friendly, and you know, you're really good to be with, and I like the way you communicate the Dharma, but I don't really like Sangharakshita. I don't like his books. They're really boring, and you know, and not sure about his life, and you know, he doesn't look that great, doesn't look like a great guru or something like that. And I have to say, well, look, sorry, you know, if you have me, you have Sangharakshita. You know, because I haven't made all this up on my own. In fact, when I look at myself, I can't find anything that doesn't really have its origins in Sangharakshita's explicit teaching or his inspiration. He is my Kalyana Mitra. He is my spiritual friend. And he, of course, doesn't see himself as completely unique. He sees himself very much as a disciple, an inheritor of the Buddha and the Buddhist tradition. And he has his own inspiration from his own teachers and friends. You know, you can't sort of divide things up like that. You can't sort of separate people out like that. It's an interconnected spiritual community. So Gampopa very much is teaching like that. And I find that wonderful, that what spiritual friendship really is. It's like this tremendous sort of reservoir of spiritual inspiration, Dharma inspiration and instruction. That we can enter into, that we can draw on, that we can participate in, that we can, you know, come together around and in. That's what it seems like to me. It's not just an exclusive friendship I might have with you or you or you. It's something much broader and deeper and larger than that. So then Gampopa talks about similes. This is another reason why spiritual friends are important. So there's scriptural authority, the tradition said so. There's necessity, because just see for yourself how difficult it is to remove those veils. You need spiritual friends to help you do that and teachers. But then similes. Similes as reasons. It's quite interesting. They love their similes, the Buddhist tradition. Similes and metaphors. In fact, one of the things that Gampopa quotes regularly from in this section on meeting spiritual friends is a sutra called the Gandavyuha Sutra. The Gandavyuha Sutra is part of an even larger sutra called the Avatamsaka Sutra, which is absolutely vast. I mean, the Gandavyuha is huge. The Avatamsaka is vast. But the Gandavyuha is really interesting because it tells the story of a pilgrim, an aspiring bodhisattva named Sudana. And Sudana is told, I think, by Manjushri, can't remember by who, but someone, to go and meet spiritual friends. And the rest of the sutra is him meeting all these different kinds of spiritual friends, Kalyana Mitras, who then pass him on to somebody else. I can't remember how many, there's loads of them, who are teaching in different things, not just things about the path, things about the Dharma, but all sorts of things like poetry and art, even sort of kind of, you know, how to run a country, absolutely everything he sort of taught, because he's training how to be a bodhisattva, to become a master of all dharmas, a master of all teachings. This is the sort of scope and range that's laid out for us, so that, you know, the bodhisattva masters all dharma, so he can use any kind of skillful means to connect people with the Dharma. So, and one of the teachers he meets is somebody called Sri Sambhava, who is described in the text as a boy or a youth, Sri Sambhava. And Sri Sambhava, all he teaches Sudana is the importance of spiritual friends, of Kalyana Mitras. And the way he does that is just by constantly using images, similes, to describe what spiritual friends are and what they do. That's all he does. It's quite interesting the way he does that. I might read some tomorrow. Anyway, there are three particular similes that Gampopa puts forward as reasons. So a spiritual friend is like a guide to unknown territory, an escort or protector in dangerous regions, and a ferryman ferrying you across a great and dangerous flooding river. This is what the primary similes that Gampopa picks out. So first of all, a guide to unknown territory. He says, well, when we practice the Dharma, we're going into unknown realms. You know, we study the texts, we take up the practices, but very often they use this imagery, the Buddha uses this imagery, you're going on a journey, you are on a path, you are the path, you are the journey, if you like, and you're moving into territory where you're going right beyond what you know. It's very important to understand this, particularly if you're thinking of making a deeper commitment to Buddhist practice, to the Dharma. You are actually signing a blank check. I don't know if you realise this. Well, probably as soon as you take up meditation, you're signing a blank check. You don't know how much it's going to cost, what you're getting into. I mean, I remember in being asked once, I think it was in India actually, a man came along and I used to teach meditation. He said, look, I want to learn meditation, but you have to guarantee me it won't change my life. I want my life to be exactly as it is. You know, with, you know, my home and family and, you know, my nice job and everything. I said, I'm sorry, I can't give you that guarantee. I really can't do that for you. I can't, I really, you know, I'm not going to take that risk because, you know, you'll want your money back. Not that he paid me anything. I can't give you that guarantee. When you meditate, anything could happen. Really, anything could happen. You're really opening up to something. When you meet with spiritual friends, anything could happen. And it could become very, very inconvenient for you as you move into unknown modes of being, as they've been called. And this is why sometimes you can reach points in your practice where it's a bit scary, because you start realizing, hey, I'm moving out of what I know. And you can feel the exhilaration, but you can also feel the discomfort. Well, this is where you need a good guide. You need a guide who can say, no, it's okay. You know, you just keep going down this path. You'll be okay. Yeah, there's a lot of changes, but it's all right. And even being quite precise about what you need to work on. I think this is another thing about spiritual friends. They don't just encourage and urge and inspire. They help you clarify. They help you clarify what's going on. And because of their greater experience, maybe they've gone through a similar experience than you, they can say, look, it's really okay. All you've got to do is keep focusing on this particular aspect of practice, or you need to put this into place, and you'll be okay if you carry on like this. So that it can be a guide. One of the beautiful things about our spiritual community, because we don't have we don't go in for one almighty guru, you know, and so on, and that we think more in terms of a range of spiritual friends and Kalyana Mitras. There's just so much experience available. So there's a lot of guides in our community. It's one of the things I really rejoice in about the order these days. So if somebody comes to me with a sort of difficulty, they're moving into unknown territory and they're not quite sure of the next step. If I don't feel that it's an area that I have knowledge or competence in, I know plenty of order members who can help. Mm. I know order members who will be able to give really good advice about and show which way to go, what not to focus on and what to focus on. So spiritual friends are very, really good guides in this way. But they won't, again, this is very important in our own community, they won't tell you what to do. This is very, very important. Well, I hope they won't. Not a good idea to tell you what to do. Unless you're very, 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 very close friends, you might be able to do it, where you really know the person very well. But usually what a spiritual friend, a good one, will do, will help you clarify your options. Clarify the situation for yourself. Because it is you who in the end have to make the decision. You know, as the Buddha famously says in the Dhammapada, the Buddha's, by you must the zealous effort be made. The Buddhas only show the way. Now, they can't do it for you. They're not going to take responsibility for you. You, in the end, have to decide. This is really, really important. But good spiritual friends will help you clarify which way to go, what to do when in times of dilemma and difficulty. Sometimes you might feel dissatisfied with what they're saying and so on. But maybe that's more to do with with your ears and your heart. You're not listening well enough. You're not listening properly. I have known people within our Sangha who go from one order member to another getting advice. Lots of conflicting advice sometimes. And they even play off order members against each other. Well, of course, they're not going to change very much while they're doing that. Because it's a way, it's a tactic of not engaging with the task, of taking individual responsibility for the journey. A few years ago, I was looking through some letters that Sangharakshita had sent me. And because I was about to give a talk on Sangharakshita's effect on me, on Bhante's effect on me, and what it was like being his disciple. Very happy to use that language. And I noticed in these letters and reflecting on conversations that from a certain point of view, the main message in all of his communication with me was the necessity of me taking individual responsibility for my life and how resistant he was to tell me anything about what to do. And even saying that I had all the wisdom necessary to make the right decision for myself and others. And he was completely confident in that. Amazing. If you like, the only advice he gave me is that you don't need any advice. You have it all there within you, which, that's quite a powerful guidance and in a way quite terrifying, to be quite honest, to be given that. So that's sometimes what the spiritual friend as a guide will do, will really throw you back on yourself. And not allow you to avoid, you know, really taking individual responsibility. So they're like guides, so that we won't go astray. Then again, spiritual friends are like a protector. This translator says an escort, but it's more like a protecting escort. And the image here is of not just unknown territory, but dangerous territory. And of course, this comes from ancient India was very lawless. A lot of where you'd be walking would be in what was known as the Mahavana, the great forest, the great jungle, and you'd only go on a journey with other people and with a really skilled and powerful protector who can take you on that journey because, you know, you might get caught by robbers and bandits. Dacoits might get you, and dacoits are bandits, Indian bandits. It still happens in India. And Gampopa, of course, is very aware of travellers in Tibet. You go in some parts of Tibet, and you're likely to be attacked by, well, even though they say they're Buddhists, but there's quite a lot of banditry in the ancient Tibet. Is it once Sangharakshita told this story of an incarnate lama friend of his who was travelling, I think, in the wastes of eastern Tibet. And because it was such a dangerous area, they didn't put the insignia on top of the stagecoach, would it have been? Something like that. The horse-drawn thing. They didn't put the insignia that it was a high-ranking spiritual teacher. They thought, well, no, let's go anonymously, because then people won't think we've got something to steal. And they were attacked by these Kumbhas, by these very fierce warriors. And then, you know, having killed a few people, they realised that there was sitting inside was an incarnate lama. And they said, why didn't you put the thing on the roof? We wouldn't have attacked you then. And they gave everything back that they robbed and said, really sorry that we killed. So it's hard to bring them back to life, you know, but you should have put that thing on the roof anyway. So dangerous realm. So the dangers that Gampopa's particularly concerned about is the danger of just falling away from the path, falling away from the path and losing the positive qualities that you've developed as you're moving towards, as he says, pleasurable forms of life. He says, because as you practice, it's not just that you're moving towards enlightenment, but as you go on, you're going to become more and more of a positive human being, and it's just going to get better and better. It's going to get more and more, you know, happy and pleasurable and joyful as you practice. This is Gampopa's perspective. But the danger is, as you go on, you start sort of settling down, or you start appropriating. You think you've arrived when you haven't. You think that you've got everything you need. I sometimes see this, you know, somebody comes along, they make a lot of effort, they make, you know, they really grow and they get some benefit, and then they think, oh, well, I've got it all now, and they make a bolt for samsara, you know, and really sort of making it in the world. And of course, very often the wheels can come off after that. That's the sort of thing that can happen. Or conceit can develop. This is another great danger. People, there is, especially if you're gifted with meditation and that kind of thing, or, you know, or perhaps even especially if you're a good speaker and you can hold an audience and things like that, you could really get into thinking that you are something special and sort of relax your efforts in practicing. If you feel that you're always having a hard time in your practice, and you still practice, and you're not particularly great, that's a really good place to be. Much better to be there, honestly. If you've got particular sort of talents that sort of operate in the world, that is an absolute curse, because you can end up relying on that and getting nowhere. Spiritual friends won't allow you to get into those dangers, which can destroy your practice through appropriating what you've attained. They'll keep you at it. They'll keep sort of challenging you. Not necessarily by giving you a telling off or anything like that. It might just be their presence keeps you honest. Keeps you aware. It's one of the things I really love about living at Padmaloka and living in a community, and living here for so long, is that I'm surrounded by people who see me in all of my different weathers. All of my different ups and downs and moods. You know, a lot of people who come on retreat, by and large, you're going to see Padmavajra in retreat mode. You know, hopefully, you know, on a good day, inspired, clear, really friendly and all that sort of thing. Hopefully, like on a good day. But friends in the community, they're going to see other sides. They're going to see my stupidity, my meanness, you know, my laziness, losing it, you know, Surita's laughing over there, getting really cranked, worried, anxious, all that sort of thing, and they can reflect that back. This is really important, and that's what I love about living with other Buddhists and being seen in the round. They see all of you, and because they see all of you and they can communicate with all of you, you can transform all of you. There isn't going to be a Buddhist bit that you do on retreat, or you do just in your meditation. It's got to be all of you. So spiritual friends will do that. They'll protect you. You know, when they see you're about to kind of drive off the proverbial cliff, you know, or the car, they can see the car wreck coming. You know, as you plunge into something really unskillful, as you're sort of intoxicated by something. They can actually prevent the crash through being a real protector. But also thinking that this business of a friend, just an ordinary friend even, as a protector on a dangerous journey, of course, it's a real archetype, isn't it, from mythology and stories. It's a lovely quality that I think we can all develop. How really looking out for our friends. I mean, do you remember Lord of the Rings? And you know, there's Frodo, but there's also Sam, isn't there? And Sam is very, very earthy, isn't he? Down to earth, and he just keeps Frodo, you know, he keeps Frodo grounded. He doesn't understand everything that's going on, but there's this tremendous protective loyalty, wonderful quality in him. He's as important to the whole story as you know, Frodo's sort of sacrifice. And we can be that for one another. It's not just the big spiritual friend that can do that. Just in life generally, being a bit of a protector. You know, when we see our friend in difficulty, whatever friend, whether they're Buddhists or non-Buddhists, whoever they are, that protective quality. In fact, when the Buddha talks about ordinary friendship in the Sigalavada Sutta, one of the first things that he says is that a friend protects. He protects you when you're heedless, when you've lost awareness, when you're intoxicated, you know, and your life is turning into a bit of a disaster. He will look out for you. He will watch over you. He'll even watch over your possessions. He'll watch over even your family, just so that you don't get into difficulty. That's a wonderful quality, just in ordinary friendship. And we can cultivate this with one another, be really watching out for one another. Not in a nosy way, but in a really kind and compassionate way. So the friend is like a protector. And then he says that the friend is like a ferryman. So the whole idea here is that this is often... And the image that's often used for samsara in the Buddhist tradition is like this great flood, you know, this powerful flood. I mean, you know, if you've ever been to it, you know, in the rainy season in India, we get floods in this country now, don't we? But in India, it's really dramatic when the rains come. Suddenly, these dry riverbeds are just these raging torrents, and they overflow their banks, and you know, they turn over, you know, villages and things like that. Extremely dangerous, very, very powerful. And the Buddha says that that's what samsara is like. You know, we don't think of our inveterate propensities and samsara, worldly life, as being like this, but it's a tremendous flood that can sweep us away into difficulties. Well, the spiritual friend, Gampopa says, is like an expert ferryman. We want to cross this flood. We want to get to the place of refuge, the dry land or the island amidst the flood, as the Buddha calls it. And we need the ferryman who can take us across. So the spiritual friend is like this. You know, he can keep us, if you like, keep us above the waters. You know, again, through instruction, through inspiration, but perhaps especially giving fearlessness. You know, giving confidence, giving courage, encouraging, you know, instilling courage. Because, you know, so often people are very fearful in life and fearful in the Dharma life. Get very afraid that they're going to lose that which they love. But of course, we gain everything through living the Dharma life. And a really good friend just gives encouragement, taking us across that flood on the ferry of the Dharma. So that's Gampopa explaining why spiritual friends are so important through scriptural authority, necessity, and through similes. So I'll stop there. It's 5 to 1, and we'll take a break there. And tomorrow we're going to talk more about... We go through the different kinds of spiritual friend and how to be with spiritual friends. That's what we'll get tomorrow. Thank you.